Okay, this is an interview with Dr. Fritz Müller by Michael Neufeld. This is November 7th, 1989. This is tape 3, side 2. Okay, let's see. We never really got to talking about your integrating accelerometer. I'm trying to remember just what it is we said in yesterday's interview, but I think you only mentioned that it had gone back to an idea of von Boyko.
Yeah. I remember this time, you know, when Boyko already suggested such systems for integrating. And around 1939, I already some work on that system in connection with that Peenemünde project. But it was not, aligned for a certain stabilized platform by that time. Mm-hmm. Because SG-66 was the only one which could accommodate such a system, and the SG-66 was not even in the planning by that time. We were mm-hmm. still working on these other systems. So it was laid out with relative large gyros.
Mm-hmm.
And
which was laid out, the accelerometer idea?
That accelerometer system, yeah. And it did not come to a real laboratory testing by that time. Mm-hmm. It was, so to say, advanced design or advanced thinking about mm-hmm. this. And then, after the successful A5 firings, Peenemünde formulated a little bit better what they wanted for the future in connection with a stabilized platform. And here it came out that they wanted accelerometer measurements and velocity measurements and distance in flight direction.
Mm-hmm.
And this led then automatically back to that advanced design which was made in connection with Boyko's ideas on a integrating accelerometer. And then when we started the layouts of the SG-66, I had to consider naturally space requirements and weight requirements in order to come up with an overall plan for the SG-66. So we did some work by that time, also preliminary work, I would say, on what could be accommodated by such a platform. We had to make a lot of compromises, you know, in order to do that. Weight, space, angular momentum of the gyro, and required accuracy. And of course, the values, the expected values for cutoff velocities and distance, all these parameters go in, and you have a lot of parameters which you have to integrate and make a compromise in that thing. And this led finally to relative small gyros, and at that time I made a preliminary layout of such an accelerometer, integrating accelerometer, in connection with a ball and disc integrator. And the whole thing was built so that that its dimensions fitted roughly the plan of the stabilized platform. This was on the beginning all what could be done, because the main push was now given to the platform itself. So we figured on substitute weights and so, you know, substitute on the beginning, because on very first tests you would not even need such a thing. You could just simulate the weight and the inertias by other means. And this was really dumb. But then, after the platform was laid out and engineering was ahead far enough, you know, that we could go on with the overall design of the platform, then I started to concentrate on that integrating system.
About what year was this now?
I would think this was already in 40 then, when we did
1940?
1940, yes. And but the main push was on the platform, even then. You know, it was mm-hmm. was not really forced forward. And then later on, in probably in 42, we made a design for that whole system. And according to that design, we built a few units. And all this went parallel to the development of the platform again. But without a real push, it was just running besides.
Mm-hmm.
And we started testing that system in the laboratory. And this was about the time we run then into 42, probably into 1942. And then Peenemünde got other thinking about this. They realized it was a relative complicated thing. And the way they wanted it, they did not just want one single gyro in a forward direction. They had developed a scheme. It was just theoretical, that they would gain better accuracy by using two gyroscopes, which were arranged under somewhat different angles. The one was in the direction of the line between start and cutoff point, and the other was a little bit inclined. It was in line with the tangent at the moment of the cutoff, which was, of course, only theoretical, because these things were not really true later on when you were firing, you know. You had somewhat, because of the errors, you had somewhat different values. But this was their theoretical consideration, and it was mainly made by Steuding and his groups. You know, these people mm-hmm. had figured out that in the overall system they would gain better accuracies if they would do it that way. So this complicated the whole thing, because now suddenly there were two measuring heads,
mm-hmm.
which, because of space requirements, required even smaller gyros.
Now let me just get a question in to anchor this. At this time, they were talking about two gyros, two gyroscopic accelerometers on the SG-66 platform.
Yes.
They weren't thinking about incorporating your accelerometer into the Siemens platform, as I know was done later on.
No, not yet. This was now just for the platform, intended for the platform. And somewhere in 1942, maybe by the end of 42, could have been the end of 42. They realized that what they wanted was much too complicated, you know, and too expensive in order to incorporate it in their system, which they developed now with Siemens. So now I also should say now, in that accelerometer development, when we did this work on that thing, Peenemünde had given this accelerometer requirements also to other places. And finally, there were about 5 places in Germany which had contracts from Peenemünde to develop some kind of accelerometer integrating systems.
Mm-hmm. All based on gyroscopic principles? Or?
No. Mm-hmm. Peenemünde had no requirement on what it should be based.
Mm-hmm.
Just find a way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So one went, what I remember, to Buchholdt, to Professor Buchholdt.
And he was where?
In Darmstadt.
Okay, he was Technische Hochschule
Darmstadt.
Mm-hmm.
And one went to Wagner.
And where was he?
I think he was also connected with Darmstadt, but mm-hmm. he also had other connections. And I think there was a Professor Hüder which was involved.
And do you have any idea where?
And there was a company involved, which was the company Ott in Kempten.
Mm-hmm. Ott, O-T-T?
O-T-T. They had a contract. And there were these people, with their Doppler systems, electronic systems.
Right, the Volman system.
Volman system, yeah.
The radio cutoff. Mm-hmm.
So, but by that time, I did not know what the others did and how far they were developed in their system. The only thing I knew, there were others in. Then, now I come back to the end of 42, when Peenemünde found out that this was too complicated, at least when I consider our thing. I didn't know what the others had by that time. And one day they approached us and wanted a much simpler system. They left out the second integration, for instance.
Meaning the integration for distance, or are you talking about the second gyro?
No, they left out the second gyro.
Mm-hmm.
They went back to one gyro. In our case, let's say they went back to one measuring head. Maybe the others had the same problem. And they went back to one integration only. They wanted to do it only with velocity. So they wanted a smaller system, with other words, and a lighter system. And the main change was they wanted to put the instrument right into the rocket without using a stabilized platform. Now, this came out of the requirement from Siemens, because Siemens did not have a platform. And of course, the disadvantage of that thing was that a measuring head put in the rocket itself would measure large error during the time when the rocket goes up vertical and during the tilting time. And they agreed to make compensations, figure all these values on standard trajectories and consider it finally in the setting of the instrument. So this was suddenly the new requirement which came up. Now, for us, it didn't mean a real, a complete new design. We could use a measuring head, and we just needed a simpler structure and needed a device for the first integration, a possibility to take out the first integral out of the system. So we changed that thing and did it in a relative short time, and then after a few months Peenemünde came up and set a deadline, and on that deadline they wanted to test all the instruments which were developed now by that time. And I remember one thing by that time. I had a discussion with Dr. Gievers by that time, and he discouraged me very much from going ahead with all that development. He was of the opinion that with that competition which we had now, you know, and on that simplified system, the competition was even worse, because it was simplified also for the other people. We would not have much chance against these people, you know. And so when the deadline came and we had our we had to present our system, I didn't even go personally to Peenemünde, you know. Mr. Mendel went there with our instrument, and it was not even, we had not even designed a new structure or so. It was situated in one of these old devices, which was now much too large, so it didn't appear to be an instrument really, you know. So we did not do that with much confidence, really, that thing.
About what time was that? Beginning of 43?
Early 43, I would suggest. And, there came the surprise. After a few days, they made all their tests, and they selected the instrument from Kreiselgeräte. Because, in spite of all the development, it was probably the most advanced system at that time, and it appeared relatively simple. So this was then the start of a redesign. We redesigned sensor instrument into another box and designed it for a larger production, you know, which differed from what we did usually on small productions. And Peenemünde put then a considerable pressure on this design, and I would say within a relative short time, it was within 43, we completed such a design and built one or two instruments in our laboratories and tested in the laboratories and delivered them to Peenemünde, and they must have performed in Peenemünde, and then from there on Peenemünde took over and accepted this device, and they gave them a contract for larger quantities. And one contract went to that company Ott, which originally had their own development. And another contract was given to a company in Vienna. The name was Medic and Schoner.
Okay, well, how do you spell that?
M-E-D-E. I think it was C.
Is that M-E-D-E or I?
M-E-E-E-C.
Mm-hmm. And
oh, I say E, I, naturally.
Yeah, this is a confusion between German and English.
Yeah, yeah.
Makes it hard. M-E-D-I-C or?
Medic, yes, that's right. Medic and Schoner.
Schoner.
S-C-H.
Like this?
O-E-R, Schoner, E-R. Medic and Schoner.
S-E-H, O umlaut or E?
O umlaut.
Okay.
So with other words, O E
R, N E R.
Yeah, Medic and Schoner.
That, so that was a company in Vienna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, to talk a little bit about the instrument itself, if you.
Yes.
I have one of these old things here. And
all right, let me just stop the tape for a second.
Okay, Dr. Miller is holding in his hands an incomplete actual example of the integrating accelerometer. Is that true?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
This is one which was actually built very likely with firm company Ott, you know, one of that mm-hmm. series. And it was brought here to the United States. The Army sold it one day as a junk mm-hmm. instrument. And a friend of mine picked it up there and gave it to me so that I would have it here in case somebody was interested. This it is built in like this here.
With the back plate is vertical.
Yeah, with the back plate vertical here hanging, see?
Mm-hmm.
And of course the axis have to be aligned with respect to the.
Okay. So the axis of the gyroscope itself is aligned vertically along the longitudinal axis.
The output axis of the gyro.
Mm-hmm.
This is the output axis here.
Mm-hmm.
And the gyro spin axis is this here.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the axis of the angular momentum.
Mm-hmm. So is the gyro spinning?
Yeah.
In this direction?
Inside, yes. Mm-hmm. Spinning is like this.
The at launch is the gyro spin axis aligned 90 degrees to the
gyro spin axis mm-hmm. is kept in a zero position, yes.
The zero position
which is 90 degrees mm-hmm. with respect to the longitudinal axis.
At launch then the spin axis of the gyro is essentially horizontal.
It's essentially horizontal, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is one part which is missing here, see?
Mm-hmm.
There is a device here which makes it possible to catch that axis here and hold it in that position
mm-hmm.
and arrest it in that position. Even when the rocket is moving a little bit, which would naturally produce
oscillation.
A motion here, it cannot do so because it is caged here. And this little device is magnetically operated. So when the rocket goes off, it retracts, and then the gyro is free and can operate. And the whole trick on the thing is that the gyro here is not supported in its sensitivity axis, normal or direct, in the axis of symmetry, but it is supported outside. So these are the bearings here, which normally are located here in the symmetry axis. Here they are outside. So as you see, gravity produces a torque here. And pulls the gyro
could
down.
Could pull a gyro down.
Yeah. And this torque, which is produced here by gravity, acts on the gyro wheel normally. And the gyro starts a precession here in this way. And according to the gyro law, that precession which is produced is proportional to the torque which is applied here on the gyro.
The downward acceleration.
Yeah, the downward torque, which is produced by acceleration or by gravity when I hold it in my hand. When the rocket goes up here, you have two factors. You have gravity and you have the acceleration. So the output superimposes two values. Now, according to the gyro law, that precessional velocity here, which will result, is proportional to the torque. With other words, proportional to acceleration.
The precession axis is vertical.
It's vertical, yes. And so if you neglect the gravity for a moment, then the precessional velocity would be a measure of the acceleration of the rocket. Now, if we can say the precessional velocity is representing the acceleration, then the angle which would be produced over time would be the integral of that acceleration. So the angle which is produced after a certain time is the first integral of the acceleration, which is the velocity. Now, the whole thing has to be so determined that you can read the overall angle after a certain time. And naturally, the requirement here is to do this so that you can get the whole range which you want to produce, let's say from 0 to 2,000 meters per second in one revolution here.
Now, I should describe this because there's no picture, unfortunately. There's a large wheel.
In this case, there is a large gear.
A large gear.
You know, because accuracy requirements force you to do certain things. You are forced to use a certain angular momentum, a small angular momentum, because of the space requirements. If you have a small angular momentum, then this requires a certain leverage here. So in order to produce a certain torque, and then you come out with, let's say, with so and so many revolutions per meter of velocity. And then you have the requirement to reduce the maximum velocity to 360 degrees. So the whole thing is a compromise out of many, many requirements which come together here. And this was actually a trick. It was an engineering problem after the principle was known. And now, so you have two disks now. The one disk is driven here by the gyro, and the other disk is essentially fixed, and it can only be driven by a hand motion here. See, when I turn this here, I can adjust that outer ring.
You adjust
here.
The scale. So there's a
it's
large...
It's a scale. It's a scale, yes.
Mm-hmm. There's a large... I have to describe this.
It is divided into degrees, you know, mm-hmm. into the 360 degrees.
Okay, let me just describe this. So there's a gearing that goes from the precession axis of the gyro up to a large gear underneath the scale, which is going to turn to indicate the axis of how far the axis of precession is from
zero to the immediate value.
And on top you have another gear, and that is there to adjust the scale.
It's a scale, and the scale is adjustable here. So you can put the scale on any value from 0 to 360 degrees. Now, you have, so to say, a table. You know, and out of this table, you can read the degrees which you have to adjust here when you want a certain velocity. Let's say you want 1,500 meters per second, and out of the table you would see this means 275 degrees. So you can adjust the scale here to 275 degrees. And since the gyro starts with a value zero, it runs and runs until it hits 275 degrees. And the point where they reach the same value is indicated by a mechanical electrical contact between the two disks here. Now, for other reasons, of course, there is a pre-contact and a main contact in order to reduce the thrust to a certain
there
value.
Was that.
And the second one is a real cutoff then.
Right. It was that they already had that as well with the other systems, which was you reduce thrust immediately before cutoff in order to reduce the error at cutoff.
So this is the principle of it. You know, here you can adjust it, and with that knob here, you can set it to zero originally.
Okay, there's two knobs on top then of the... Again, I'm describing this for the record. There's a second... There's two knobs on the left over top of the scale, the disc. There's the knob for adjusting the cutoff point, and on the right, there's a knob for zeroing the gyroscope.
To make sure the gyro starts on zero. Zero position. This is this one here. And and then that mechanism, which is not shown here, holds the thing there. Now, here, in operating of such a gyroscope here, you have again the usual problems with a gyro, friction, disturbing friction, and other disturbing torques. What I said here, the torque would produce a precessional velocity through only for a very short time. After a short time, the gyro would slowly sink down here because the precessional motion has to go against friction, which naturally produces reverse action in the gyro. And the reverse action is that the gyro will yield to that torque here and make a precession and drop down. So dropping down is actually a reverse precessional motion proportional to the torques which are encountered. Because the gyro law is only true when you have no disturbances, no friction, nothing from the outside. Yeah, you have the friction. So,
let me ask a question here: Is the gyro being driven continuously, or is it going on momentum?
No, it's continuously driven.
But there are friction losses anyway.
Yeah, but again, this is a friction in the gyro wheel, which you overcome by putting energy in. You know, but the friction when the gyro processes here, see, this friction is not overcome from the outside so far as my explanation goes. Now, we have to do something to eliminate this friction on the outside. And therefore, there is a little motor here put on, which you don't see here.
It's missing
right now. And here is a gearing connection with that motor. And this motor is called sometimes an anti-friction motor. Sometimes it's called a support motor for the gyro. This is one which was used in such instruments. Mm-hmm. It has a small gear here inside, and that small gear mm-hmm. operates with a large gear ratio here on that outer wheel here, see? That wheel on the precession axis.
Okay, so and you're holding it, for the record, you're holding a small cylindrical electric motor about an inch long, approximately, yeah. with a small gear on top,
yeah.
which gears with the wheel on the bottom yeah. of the precession axis.
Yeah.
Of the
on the precession. And this motor has to be controlled now by the gyro. Yeah. And again, yeah, you can see here the mechanism which operates the motor. It is a primitive thing. It is just a contact mechanism which gives a plus or minus.
Mm-hmm. So motor, on the left-hand side of the
yeah.
of the gyro itself, there's a small metal strip that can touch either the top or bottom contacts.
Yeah. Now, this motor is built in such a way that when it touches the bottom, it turns in one direction. When it touches the upper part, it would turn in the other direction. And since we call this a black and white, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's not a servo system as people would use it today. It's again, the servo problems were still there by that time, and they were real problems, so we had to go along with such a on and off contact. And now when the gyro starts to drop down and it gives contact on the lower contact area here, then the motor produces a torque which goes in the other direction and brings the gyro up,
mm-hmm.
helps to process the gyro up. And this torque is naturally too large because it has to be overdimensioned. So the contact goes off again. And when the thing is operating, the contact operates with a relative high frequency all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And
on and off, on and off.
On and off. And what we produce is an average value. It's a poor system.
mm-hmm.
But everything was so determined here, or had to be so determined, that in the overall we gained an accuracy which was acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a, to sum up, this is a, the microphone. This reduced the inaccuracies because yeah. of friction losses
yeah, you
in the precession axis.
To a certain extent we could optimize the thing. Also, that we would come to a minimum error. By using the spring, as you see here, the spring constant, this is a spring here where the middle contact is on, in connection with the angular momentum, with the reaction of the gyro, in order to produce such a frequency with such a small amplitude that it would be tolerable. These are compromises which had to be made at that time. And now there is another requirement in here which came in by the decision of Peenemünde to put that instrument rocket fixed in. When when the program angle starts to operate and the rocket turns around,
it here, begins to pitch along the program trajectory.
Then you in certain positions, you operate against the gyro. When the gyro is, for instance, in set position, the turning would occur around the spin axis. There would be no effect. But in the 90-degree position here,
when the gyro rocket is turning, facing out horizontally,
the gyro has to be turned with the rocket.
So it will tend to tilt upwards. So,
It would tend. And in this case, you have to produce a torque here, which processes the gyro around, and this is according to a sine function. You know, because this is rotating, here is the maximum, here is zero. So you have to produce torques according to a sine function.
Okay, so let me just interrupt you for a second. The effect is zero when the spin axis is pointed essentially along the pitch axis of the vehicle. But when the gyro is facing along the yaw axis at a 90 degrees effectively, on this or on this thing sort of directly outwards from the back plate, or vice versa in the other direction, when it's pointing along the yaw axis, that's when the disturbance is the greatest.
Yeah, so disturbance is greatest when the axis, the spin axis, is in the plane of the turning. This is in the plane of the turning. Then it is greatest. And it is zero when the spin axis is normal to the plane of turning. And of course, this here, the maximum value changes with regard to the gyro. It is different here from what it is down here. Once it needs an upper contact, once it needs a lower contact.
Right.
And this whole procedure here was only due to the fact that the instrument is now rocket fixed.
Right, it's not on a stabilized
platform. Not on a stabilized platform. There is no problem like this on a stable platform. Now, that what I explained here, this problem is the same problem what we had in the A3 missile, when the missile or the rocket tried to rotate around the longitudinal axis. And we had to follow with the stabilization gyros. We talked about this yesterday. And this is the same problem here, which occurred here. Now, this was one of the main problems here. And another problem is, of course, to keep the disturbing moments small from the very beginning. So here is a problem to support a relative heavy gyro on a lever arm here in a bearing and make it so that you have a minimum of friction in that thing. Even ball bearing friction is much too large, you know, especially today. By that time, of course, it was not so bad, but even ball bearing friction would have been too much of an error, sir, here in that thing. So the problem was to to find a bearing support which would reduce even a normal ball bearing friction. And since we did not have anything else, we did not have air bearings by that time, I found finally a solution here in that thing, which can be seen here. See, this is one of these gyros which is supported.
Okay, this is a spare example of the gyro.
Yeah, it's just a sample of one of these gyros here. And you see here a little ball here, you know, carried on a little stud here, and this is a hardened steel ball which can be inserted here in a special bearing housing. First, we used stones, you know, like in the clock manufacturing, the stones which are used sometimes, and later on...
You mean a gemstone?
Yeah, gemstones. Mm-hmm. But later on, we found out a certain bronze was the best value.
A certain what?
Bronze. You know, alloy.
Alloy, okay, mm-hmm. Bronze. Okay, bronze, I didn't understand the word. Mm-hmm.
And this thing has to be so determined that when the instrument operates and it vibrates, you know, there's always a certain vibration in when mm-hmm. it operates, to minimize the friction.
Mm-hmm.
So you never have a real...
I have to stop this.